All right, before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Oh, yeah, they're great.
Yeah, if you're prepping for the Series 65, they have this full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and like unlimited practice exams.
Which is huge, especially for the quantitative stuff we're doing today.
Totally. The exams are weighted exactly like the real thing, so check it out at certfuel.com. Keep it quick, keep it casual. Anyway, let's get into it. So think about this. If you were like building a house, right?
Okay.
You wouldn't just stare at a pile of 2x4s, cross your arms, squint a little bit, and say, "Ah, yeah, that feels like a sturdy living
I
room."
mean, hopefully not. You'd use a tape measure.
All right.
You'd use a level. You use a plumb line to make sure the walls are actually straight, you know? Building requires strict quantifiable tools because, well, gravity just doesn't care about your intuition.
Gravity's ruthless. But for some reason, when people look at the stock market, suddenly they throw the tape measure right out the window.
Oh, all the time.
They pull up a squiggly green line on a brokerage app on their phone. They look at a logo and they literally say, "The vibes are immaculate. I heard about this on a podcast. This stock is definitely going to the moon."
Which is exactly how you build a financial house that, completely collapses the moment the economic winds shift. As an investment advisor, your entire job, like your legal and ethical mandate, is to not rely on vibes.
Right. The SEC doesn't care about vibes.
Exactly. You need your tape measures. You need objective mathematical tools to justify why a specific asset belongs in a specific client's portfolio.
And that is exactly what we are handing you today. We are going to build your analytical toolkit. So here's the mission. We are diving deep into the analytical methods section for the Series 65 exam.
It's a heavy section.
It is. And look, I am talking directly to you right now. You need to learn this material. You need to retain it. But more importantly, you need to be able to pull it out of your brain under pressure, sitting in that, like, completely silent, overly air-conditioned testing center.
Right, when the clock is ticking.
Yeah. So we are officially ditching the dry, dusty textbook approach today. Reading a formula off a page just doesn't work for most people. I have ADHD, so if you just read me a textbook, I will literally zone out in 10 seconds.
We need to make it stick.
We're going to use ridiculous, memorable scenarios. If a concept can be explained through a weird hypothetical, we're doing it. The weirder it is, the better it sticks.
And the why behind this is critical, you know? You cannot sit across a mahogany desk from a prospective client, look at their retirement nest egg, and say, "Ah, I just have a really good feeling about this tech stock."
Yeah, that's a quick way to lose a license.
The regulators definitely frown on that. You need tools to make defensible, highly rigorous decisions on valuation, on risk, and on historical performance.
So to help us visualize all these tools, I want to introduce the cast of characters who will be joining us today. These are three recurring friends, and by the end of this deep dive, you are going to know them intimately.
I love these guys.
Right. Okay, first, we have Steady Stan. Stan runs a boring, incredibly predictable, slow-growth utility company.
We're talking like water treatment, power lines, maybe some municipal trash collection.
Exactly. Steady Stan is the kind of business owner who probably goes to bed at 8:30 p.m. every single night.
He definitely wears socks with sandals, and his revenue streams are locked in by government contracts. The company puts you to sleep, which, frankly, is often exactly what you want anchoring a portfolio.
Our second character is Frantic Fiona. Fiona is a chaotic, highly caffeinated tech startup founder. Her business model is a complete financial roller coaster.
What's she pivoting to this week?
Right now, she's pivoting her company from artificial intelligence to blockchain supply chains to, I don't know, digital pet rocks that live in the metaverse.
Perfect. Fiona represents the allure of the unknown. It's high potential reward, but incredibly high risk. Her company is basically the textbook definition of volatility.
And finally, we have Clueless Craig. Craig is our well-meaning but incredibly naive retail investor.
Bless his heart.
Craig means well. He reads a few financial blogs, but he's fundamentally attracted to shiny objects, and he always falls for the exact traps the Series 65 exam is going to try to set for you.
We are absolutely going to use Craig as our canary in the coal mine today. When you see Craig making a decision, you should immediately ask yourself what mathematical rule he is actively ignoring.
Okay, so let's start building the foundation. Before we can even begin to analyze how Frantic Fiona's stock behaves or whether Steady Stan's utility company is a good buy, we have to agree on what a dollar is actually worth.
Right.
And that brings us to the time value of money, or TVM.
This is the bedrock, like the absolute bedrock of all investment valuation. If you don't grasp this, literally none of the subsequent formulas will make sense.
No pressure.
The core philosophy is pretty straightforward, though. A dollar in your hand today is worth more than a dollar promised to you in the future.
Okay, but I want to push back on that conceptually for a second. A dollar is a dollar. A $1 bill printed in 2020 buys the same pack of, well, okay, maybe not with inflation, but you know what I mean.
I know what you mean.
Why is the intrinsic value of that piece of paper different based on the calendar?
It comes down to opportunity cost and risk. If I hand you a dollar today, you have immediate utility. You can spend it, or more importantly, for our purposes, you can invest it.
Right.
If you put that dollar in a savings account or a treasury bond today, it immediately begins earning a return. If I simply promise to give you a dollar 10 years from now, you are losing out on a decade of potential growth.
Plus the risk that you might just disappear and not pay me.
Exactly. You take on the risk that I might go bankrupt and never pay you that dollar.
So time literally equals money.
Precisely. So let's quantify that growth. This is the concept of future value, or FV, and the underlying engine driving it is compounding.
Now, the formula for future value always looks super intimidating to people who haven't done algebra in a while.
It does, yeah.
It's PV, present value, the money you have today multiplied by 1 plus R, which is your rate of return. And then you take that whole thing in the parentheses and raise it to the power of N, which is the number of periods or years.
To put it simply, FV equals PV times 1 plus R to the nth power.
I always visualize compounding as a snowball, right? Rolling down a really long snow-covered hill. You pack a small snowball, that's your present value, your initial investment.
Right.
You give it a push. As it completes its first rotation, the new snow sticks to it. That's your first year of interest. But here's the magic part. On the second rotation, the snowball is wider.
Its surface area is larger.
Exactly. So it picks up even more snow than it did the first time. You aren't just earning interest on your original money, you are earning interest on the interest you already earned.
Let's plug Clueless Craig into that snowball analogy. Let's say Craig inherits $10,000 from his aunt.
Good for Craig.
He decides to invest it today at a guaranteed 6% annual return, and he plans to leave it there for 5 years.
Okay, so using our formula, the present value is 10,000. Our rate was 0.06. Our period's n is 5.
Right.
So the math is 10,000 times 1.06 raised to the fifth power. Let me run that in my head, or pretend to run it. 1.06 to the fifth power is about 1.3382.
Yep. Multiply that factor by Craig's initial $10,000, and his future value is $13,382.
Okay, so that extra $3,382 isn't money Craig worked for. He didn't lift a finger. That is just the new snow sticking to the snowball.
Exactly. Now, let's bring this into the context of the testing room. The Series 65 exam knows you have a basic calculator, but they also really want to test your conceptual agility.
They want to know if you get it, not just if you can punch buttons.
Right. Sometimes they want to know if you understand the timeline intuitively without punching out complex exponents.
Okay, so to the listener, ask yourself this. Think about it for a beat before we answer. If Clueless Craig gets an 8% return on a new investment, approximately how long will it take for his money to completely double in size?
Give them a second to think.
Okay, so if you're furiously trying to do algebra in your head, just stop. You use the rule of 72.
A classic.
You literally just take the number 72 and you divide it by the annual rate of return as a whole number. So 72 divided by 8 equals 9. It will take Craig approximately 9 years to turn his 10 grand into 20 grand.
But you need to be extremely careful here. The test writers love to exploit ambiguity with this rule.
How so?
The rule in 72 is an approximation. It is a mental math shortcut that works surprisingly well for normal interest rates, but it is not an exact mathematical proof.
So how do they trap you with that on the exam?
If an exam question explicitly asks approximately how long to double, or which of the following is the closest estimate, that is your neon flashing sign to use the rule of 72. But if a question asks for the exact future value of an account and gives you multiple choice answers that are only a few dollars apart, well, you cannot use the shortcut. You must use the full formula.
And Clueless Craig always uses the shortcut and ends up picking the answer that is off by $40.
Every single time.
Don't be Craig. Read the phrasing of the question.
Okay, so that's pushing the snowball forward down the hill to figure out what it will become. But what if we want to reverse time?
Like time travel.
Yeah. What if we know what the snowball looks like at the bottom of the hill, and we need to know what it looked like at the very top? That brings us to present value, or PV.
Present value is just the mirror image of future value. The process is called discounting.
Okay.
Instead of multiplying our money by an interest factor to see it grow, we divide our future money by that factor to shrink it back to today's dollars. The formula is simply FV divided by 1 plus R to the nth power. Think of a seesaw. There is a delicate balance between time, interest rates, and value. Let's walk through a specific scenario. Let's say frantic Fiona promises to pay clueless Craig exactly $10,000.
Oh boy.
Right? Craig decides his required rate of return, like his personal discount rate to make this risk worthwhile, is 6%.
Okay, so if Fiona hands him that $10,000 in exactly 1 year, what is the present value of that promise? We take 10,000 and divide it by 1.06 to the first power.
10,000 divided by 1.06 is $9,434. So Fiona's promise of 10 grand next year is only worth about $9,400 to Craig today.
But what if Fiona says she can't pay him for 10 years because her crypto startup is pivoting again?
Standard Fiona.
Now we have to discount that same $10,000 across an entire decade. We take 10,000 and divide it by 1.06 raised to the 10th power.
The present value plummets. I mean, it drops all the way down to $5,584.
This creates a critical dynamic that you really must internalize for the test. I've seen candidates get completely twisted around on this during the exam.
Looks the trap.
Holding the interest rate constant, giving an investment more time, will increase its future value because compounding has longer to work.
Right, the snowball gets bigger.
But more time will decrease its present value because the discounting mechanism has a heavier penalty. You're waiting longer to get paid.
That makes total sense when you break it down like that. But if you're rushing through a question, it's so easy to just assume more time means more money.
It's a natural instinct, but it's wrong.
It entirely depends on which direction you are traveling on the timeline. If you're looking forward, time is your friend. If you're waiting to get paid, time is your enemy.
Exactly. And understanding that seesaw effect is what leads us to the heavyweight title fight of the analytical methods section. Net present value versus internal rate of return, NPV versus IRR.
The big ones.
These are the two primary tools an advisor uses to answer the ultimate question from a client, which is, should I actually buy this specific asset?
So let's start with net present value, NPV. What is it at its core?
NPV is the present value of all future cash flows an investment would generate, minus the initial cost of buying the investment today.
Okay.
And this is vital. NPV is expressed in dollars. It gives you a strict dollar amount of value created or destroyed.
Let's make this tangible. Clueless Craig finds a private investment opportunity. The buy-in cost is exactly $10,000 today.
All right.
In exchange, the investment promises to pay him $4,000 a year for the next 3 years. Craig decides his personal hurdle rate, the minimum return he needs to justify locking up his money, is 6%.
So we have a timeline here. Year zero, negative $10,000. That's the cost out of his pocket. Year one, positive 4,000. Year two, positive 4,000. Year three, positive 4,000.
Okay, so Craig gets 12,000 total.
But we cannot just add 4, 4, and 4 and say he made 12,000. We have to discount each of those future payments back to year zero using his 6% rate.
Right, because the 4,000 he gets in year three is worth way less than the 4,000 he gets in year one.
Correct. So we divide the year one payment by 1.06. We divide the year two payment by 1.06 squared. We divide the year three payment by 1.06 cubed.
Okay, I actually ran the numbers on this. The present value of the year one payment is $3,774. Year two's payment is worth $3,560. And year three's payment is worth $3,358 in today's terms.
So you add those three present values together. The total present value of the cash flowing into Craig's pocket is $10,692.
Okay, so the future benefits expressed in today's dollars equal $10,692. But Craig has to pay $10,000 today to get them.
Right, so we subtract the initial cost. 10,692 minus 10,000 leaves us with a net present value of positive $692.
It's a positive NPV. The decision rule is simple, right? If the NPV is greater than zero, you accept the investment.
Exactly. It means the investment is generating more value than it costs, even after strictly accounting for your required 6% rate of return.
But I want to throw a curveball here for you listening. Ask yourself this: what if Craig ran all this math? And the net present value wasn't positive $600. What if the MPV was exactly $0.00?
Oh, good question.
Did Craig lose money? Was it a massive waste of his time? Think about it for a beat.
This is a massive conceptual trap on the test. A zero NPV does not mean you made zero profit. It does not mean you broke even in cash terms.
Right.
A zero NPV means the investment earned exactly your required rate of return.
So if the MPV was zero, Craig still made his 6%.
Yes. Mathematically, you are indifferent to taking the project or leaving the money in your pocket. But fundamentally, it is still a good investment because it successfully met your hurdle rate. It simply didn't exceed it.
But clueless Craig looks at a zero NPV and just throws the prospectus in the trash.
And he shouldn't. It met his requirement.
Okay, so NPV gives us a strict dollar amount. Now let's look at the challenger, internal rate of return, or IRR. If I'm an advisor, a lot of clients don't want to hear about present value dollars.
Yeah, they don't.
They want to know, what's my percentage yield? That's what IRR does, right?
Correct. If NPV tells you the dollar amount of value added, IRR tells you the percentage rate of return.
Okay.
The technical definition is that IRR is the exact discount rate that makes the net present value exactly zero.
It's the break-even interest rate.
Yeah,
it solves the algebra backward to find the percentage.
Yeah.
And the rule is, if the IRR is higher than your required rate of return, you do the deal.
Right. But here is the most heavily tested concept in this entire section. What happens when these two metrics disagree?
Oh, the tiebreaker.
Let's say you have two mutually exclusive projects. You only have enough capital to pick one. Project A looks vastly superior based on NPV. Project B looks vastly superior based on IRR. Which metric wins the tiebreaker?
I always used to think IRR would win. Higher percentage yield just sounds better.
And that's the trap. NPV wins. Always. Dollars beat percentages.
But I need to understand the underlying mechanics here, because just memorizing rules is how I fail tests. Why does NPV overrule IRR?
It all comes down to a hidden flaw in the math, and it's called the reinvestment assumption. Both of these formulas are built on a very specific premise.
What's that?
When you receive those interim cash flows, like Craig's $4,000 at the end of year one, the math assumes you don't just stick that cash under your mattress.
Right.
It assumes you immediately reinvest it to keep compounding.
You have to keep the snowball rolling.
Exactly. But the two formulas assume you reinvest that cash at radically different rates. IRR assumes you are able to reinvest all interim cash flows at the magical high IRR rate itself.
Oh.
So, if Frantic Fiona pitches you a project with a jaw-dropping IRR of 25%, the IRR formula automatically assumes that when she pays you your first dividend, you can instantly turn around and find another investment in the market paying exactly 25%.
Which is wildly unrealistic. If my normal hurdle rate is 6%, finding a 25% return is like a once-in-a-decade miracle. I can't just replicate miracles on demand every time a dividend check clears.
Precisely. The IRR artificially inflates its own value by assuming you have infinite access to equally amazing projects.
And what does NPV assume?
NPV, on the other hand, assumes you reinvest those interim cash flows at your standard discount rate, your required rate of return.
Which in Craig's case was 6%.
Yeah.
That is highly realistic. If he gets a $4,000 check, he can easily go find a boring municipal bond or index fund paying his baseline 6%.
Because the reinvestment assumption of LPV is grounded in economic reality, NPV gives you a much more honest, accurate picture of the actual wealth you are creating.
So that is why NPV is the undisputed champion when conflicts arise. Dollars over percentages. Because the underlying assumption is realistic.
You got it.
I love that explanation. It makes it so much more than just a rule to memorize. Okay, I need to pause the tape right here. I am stepping out of the narrative. Wherever you are listening, make a mental note of this next sentence because it is basically free points on the exam. Are you listening?
This is a major vocabulary trick they use.
Yes. For fixed income securities, for bonds, the internal rate of return is the exact same mathematical concept as the yield to maturity. IRR equals YTM.
The exam writers will deliberately use these terms interchangeably to induce panic.
They will give you a word problem about a corporate bond's IRR and you'll freeze because you only studied yield to maturity for the bond section.
Don't let them trick you. If they ask for the bond's IRR, just calculate the YTM.
It's the exact same formula, just different nomenclature depending on whether you were talking to corporate finance people or bond traders. All right, take a breath. We have officially survived the time value of money. We know how to move dollars across the timeline. Now, we need to transition into looking at historical data. We have to establish normal.
Because before we can measure how crazy a stock gets, which is how we define risk, we have to establish a baseline of what a typical day or year actually looks like for that asset.
Right.
We do this using measures of central tendency.
We can't know how far a pendulum swings until we know exactly where the center is. And to find the center, we use mean, median, and mode.
Let's define the terminology quickly. The mean is your standard arithmetic average. You add all the observation values together and divide by the total number of observations.
Right.
The median is the exact middle value when you sort all the data points in sequential order.
Sort being the keyword.
Yes. And the mode is simply the value that occurs most frequently in the data set.
Let's bring frantic Fiona back into the studio. Let's look at the annual returns of her startup over its first 5 years. The returns are 6%, 4%, 11%, 10%, and 4%.
Okay, let's calculate her baseline. To find the mean, we add 6, 4, 11, 10, and 4. That equals 35.
Then we divide 35 by the 5 years of data, and the mean return is 7%.
Got it. The average is 7. Now let's find the median. The biggest mistake people make here is just picking the middle number from the raw list.
You have to sort them first.
Always. So we sort them. 4, 4, 6, 10, 11. What is the number sitting right in the middle? It's 6. So the median is 6%.
And finally, the mode. Which number repeats the most? 4% appears twice. Every other return only happened once. So the mode is 4%.
And just a quick note for the test. If no numbers ever repeated, there would simply be no mode.
Okay, that feels like elementary school math. Where is the trap?
The trap is understanding why we have these different metrics, and it involves a concept called skewness.
Skewness.
The mean works beautifully for Steady Stan, whose returns are symmetrical. But what happens when Fiona has a wildly unpredictable year?
Let's say in year 6, Fiona's blockchain pet rocks go viral on TikTok and her stock rockets up 50%.
If we calculate a new mean with that data, that one massive 50% outlier drags the entire mathematical average violently upward.
Right.
The mean might suddenly look like 15%, but is 15% a normal expectation for her stock? No. In almost every other year, she only returned between 4 and 11%. The mean becomes highly deceptive because of one freak event.
But the median is immune to that freak event.
Exactly. The median does not care about the magnitude of the outlier. It only cares about its position in the line.
No one's smart.
Whether Fiona gained 50% or 5,000%, that number just sits at the far right end of our sorted list. The middle number barely shifts at all.
So when dealing with highly skewed data like tech stocks or venture capital or even real estate prices in a weird neighborhood, the median is a far more honest representation of a typical result than the mean. Let's test this intuition for everyone listening. Listen closely to this scenario. If a client's portfolio has a median historical return of 7%, but the mean historical return is only 4%, which way did the outliers pull the data?
Did this client experience a really spectacular year or a genuinely terrible year?
Think about it. The answer is they had a terrible year.
Think about the mechanics. The median, the typical middle of the road year, is a solid 7%. But the mean, the arithmetic average, got dragged all the way down to 4%.
Yeah.
The only way that happens mathematically is if a few exceptionally poor returns, massive unexpected losses, acted like an anchor and yanked the average way below the typical result.
You need to know the official terminology for this because the exam will ask you to identify the skew based only on comparing these two numbers without seeing any actual data.
Right.
When the mean is pulled down lower than the median, this is called left skewed or negative skew.
Mm-hmm.
When the mean is pulled up higher than the median by a massive lottery ticket gain, that is right skewed or positive skew.
The easiest way to remember this under pressure: the skew follows the mean. If the mean is dragged to the left, meaning it is a lower number than the median, the data is left skewed. If the mean is dragged to the right higher than the median, it is right skewed.
The skew follows the mean. That is a brilliant heuristic. Okay, so we've established the center. We know what normal is. Now we have to figure out how wild the roller coaster gets.
Which brings us to measuring risk and volatility. An investment advisor has to quantify exactly how far an asset swings away from its expected center.
The quickest, easiest way to measure that swing is range. You just take the highest return and subtract the lowest return.
Right. Back to Fiona's original 5 years. Her absolute high was 11%. Her absolute low was 4%. 11 minus 4 is 7. Her range is 7%.
But range is limited.
Very. It's easy to calculate, but it is a very weak analytical tool because it completely ignores every piece of data that happened between the highest and lowest points.
To truly map out the roller coaster of an investment's volatility, we have to use standard deviation.
Oh, standard deviation. When people hear this, they immediately picture the classic bell curve.
Yes, the normal distribution. Standard deviation quantifies the dispersion of returns around the mean. Conceptually, it's calculating the average distance that every single historical return fell away from the center point.
And before we do the math, we need to hammer home a definition. Whenever you see standard deviation on this exam, what specific phrase should instantly pop into your head?
Total risk.
Yes. Standard deviation is the primary mathematical measure of total risk, which is the combination of both systematic risk and unsystematic risk. We will define those terms shortly, but drill this into your memory. Standard deviation equals total risk.
Higher standard deviation means a wider bell curve, more volatility, and therefore higher risk. Lower standard deviation means a tight, steep bell curve, highly stable, and lower risk.
Let's explore the rules of the bell curve, known statistically as the 68-95-99 rule.
This rule is so cool.
Assuming a normal distribution of returns, statistical law dictates that roughly 68% of all future outcomes will fall within one standard deviation of the mean, plus or minus.
Okay.
95% of outcomes will fall within two standard deviations, and 99% will fall within three.
I want to walk through the math step by step so you can actually hear how an advisor would use this in a client meeting.
Let's do it.
Let's say Clueless Craig is looking at an index fund. The fund has a historical expected return, a mean of 8.7%. The prospectus lists the standard deviation as 14.6%.
Craig asks you, what are the odds I lose my shirt this year? Walk us through calculating the 68% probability bounds.
Okay, we start by anchoring ourselves to the mean, 8.7%. The rule tells us that 68% of the time, the return will land within plus or minus one standard deviation of that center point.
So we calculate the downside first.
Yes. 8.7 minus one standard deviation, which is 14.6. 8.7 minus 14.6 leaves us at negative 5.9%. That is the bottom boundary of our 68% range.
So a loss of roughly 6%. Now for the upside boundary.
We take the mean of 8.7 and we add 14.6. That equals positive 23.3%.
This is incredibly powerful. Instead of just saying it's a risky fund, you can look Craig in the eye and say, Craig, based on the math, there is a 68% statistical probability that your return over the next 12 months will land somewhere between losing 5.9% and gaining 23.3%.
And if Craig says a 68% chance isn't comforting enough, what's the worst case scenario?
You expand the curve to two standard deviations, which covers 95% of all probable outcomes. You simply double the standard deviation. 14.6 times 2 is 29.2.
Okay, let's run the wider bounds. Downside. 8.7 minus 29.2 is negative 20.5%. Upside, 8.7 plus 29.2 is positive 37.9%.
So you tell Craig, there is the 95% probability your return will be between a 20.5% loss and a 37.9% gain.
The wider the range you quote, the higher your statistical confidence that the actual result will land inside it.
This really explains the fundamental difference between our characters.
Okay.
Look at Steady Stan. Let's say his utility stocks mean is 5% and his standard deviation is only 2%.
Okay.
His 68% range is remarkably tight between 3% and 7%. It is a gentle Sunday drive.
Then look at Frantic Fiona. Let's say her tech stock also has a mean of 5%, but her standard deviation is 30%.
Ah.
Yeah, her 68% range swings violently from losing 25% to gaining 35%. They have the exact same mathematical average, but the investor experience is completely different. Stan lets you sleep. Fiona requires motion sickness pills.
Before we move on, I want to reiterate the trap.
Yeah.
What is the one thing candidates confuse standard deviation with?
Beta. They always confuse it with beta.
Yes. Standard deviation measures total risk. It measures the asset completely in isolation. If a question asks which metric evaluates total risk, the answer is standard deviation. Beta does something very different, which brings us to the next vital concept.
Welcome to the market ocean. We are now transitioning from looking at assets in isolation to looking at how they behave when we drop them into the broader economy.
Exactly. Standard deviation asks, how volatile is Frantic Fiona's stock all by itself? But stocks don't exist in a vacuum. To build a proper portfolio, we need to know what happens to Fiona's stock when the entire stock market crashes or rallies.
This is where we break total risk down into its two component parts: unsystematic risk and systematic risk.
Unsystematic risk is company-specific risk. It's the risk that Fiona's lead developer quits, or her their house burns down, or a competitor launches a better product.
Right.
Systematic risk is market risk. It's the risk that inflation spikes, interest rates double, or a global pandemic shuts down the entire economy.
Unsystematic risk can be mitigated through diversification. If you own 30 different stocks in 30 different industries, Fiona's warehouse burning down barely dents your portfolio.
True.
But you cannot diversify away systematic risk. If the entire economy goes into a recession, almost every stock goes down.
And that systematic, undiversifiable market risk is exactly what beta measures.
I want to use my absolute favorite analogy here.
Yeah.
Let's imagine the entire stock market, like the S&P 500 index, is the ocean.
The ocean.
Beta is a specific measurement of how much your individual boat rocks when a wave hits the ocean.
By definition, the market itself, the S&P 500, is assigned a baseline beta of exactly 1.0. The market is the ocean. It sets the standard.
So let's look at the boats our characters are piloting. Steady Stan's utility company is a massive, heavy, flat-bottomed iron barge.
It has a beta of less than 1. Let's say its beta is 0.6. What happens when a wave hits the ocean?
The barge barely notices. Because its beta is less than 1.0, it rocks less violently than the water around it. If the market ocean drops 10%, Stan's stock might only drop 6%. It is defensive.
Now, what about frantic Fiona?
Fiona is riding a high-powered jet ski. She has a beta much greater than 1. Let's say her beta is 1.8.
Oh, it's jumpy.
Very. When that same wave hits the ocean, the jet ski goes flying into the air. It amplifies the movement of the water. If the market goes up 10%, Fiona's stock might rocket up 18%. But if the market drops, she crashes twice as hard.
And what if clueless Craig gets scared and puts his money in a 91-day treasury bill? The risk-free rate.
A T-bill is a boat parked securely on dry land. It has a beta of 0. The ocean could suffer a massive tsunami and the T-bill will not move. It is zero correlation to systematic equity market risk.
Let's do some quick mental math to make sure this is locked in. Listen to this scenario and ask yourself what the outcome should be.
Go ahead.
Clueless Craig decides to buy a high-growth ETF with a stated beta of 1.3. A month later, the Federal Reserve raises interest rates unexpectedly, and the overall stock market drops by 10%. Mathematically, what should happen to Craig's ETF?
Okay, think about it. You simply take the market's movement, negative 10%, and multiply it by his beta of 1.3. Negative 10 times 1.3 equals negative 13. Craig's portfolio drops by 13%.
He took on more systematic risk than the market, so he suffered a steeper loss.
Simple math, but I need to flag a massive trap right here. The exam loves to test your conceptual understanding of the relationship between beta and diversification.
They will ask you, an investor adds 40 randomly selected large cap stocks to their portfolio. What happens to their beta?
Oh, this is such a classic trick. Craig always says, well, diversification reduces risk, so the beta must go down.
And Craig is entirely wrong. Diversification reduces unsystematic company-specific risk. But beta is strictly a measure of systematic market risk. You cannot diversify away the ocean.
Right.
Adding 40 random stocks to a portfolio will likely bring the portfolio's beta closer to 1.0 because you are essentially just rebuilding the index. But diversification as a strategy is not designed to reduce beta.
You can own 1,000 boats, but if a hurricane hits the ocean, they're all getting wet.
Exactly.
Okay, so beta measures how much we are at the mercy of the market. But what if a portfolio manager manages to actually beat the market? What if they steer their boat perfectly through the storm? That brings us to alpha.
Alpha is the holy grail for active managers. It measures manager skill. The technical definition is that alpha is the excess return of an investment relative to its expected return based strictly on the level of risk it took.
I really want to emphasize this because it's a profound concept in finance. Alpha is not just a fancy word for your total return.
Right.
Alpha answers the question. Did you actually do a good job picking stocks, or did you just take on a massive amount of leverage and get lucky in a bull market?
Exactly. The formula at its simplest is actual return minus expected return. And we usually calculate that expected return using CAPM, the capital asset pricing model.
Which factors in the risk-free rate, the market return, and the portfolio's beta.
Right. Let's set the scene. Clueless Craig goes to a dinner party. He's holding a glass of wine, speaking very loudly, bragging to everyone that his personal portfolio returned 14% this year.
Oh, classic Craig.
The overall market only returned 10%. Craig thinks he is a genius. He thinks he generated 4% of pure alpha.
But Craig isn't telling the whole story. Craig's portfolio is entirely composed of tech stocks and leveraged ETFs. His portfolio beta is 1.5. He took on 50% more systematic risk than the market ocean.
Right. So we run Craig's numbers through CAPM to find out what he should have earned just for taking on that much risk. Let's say mathematically, based on a beta of 1.5, his expected return was actually 15%.
Okay, so now we find the alpha. Craig's actual return was 14%. His expected return, based on his massive risk, was 15%. Actual minus expected, 14 minus 15, leaves Craig with an alpha of negative 1.0%.
Craig isn't a genius. He actually destroyed value. He took on a ton of risk, endured a terrifying roller coaster, and underperformed the math. He would have been better off just buying a passive index fund and leveraging it.
A positive alpha means the manager added genuine value, right? They outperformed their risk-adjusted expectation. A negative alpha means they failed to justify the risk they took.
And a zero alpha, which is what the efficient market hypothesis argues most managers will eventually hit, means they performed exactly as the math predicted they would. Alpha separates luck from skill.
Okay, we are moving seamlessly into the next phase. We have separated risk by looking at standard deviation and beta. We have separated return by looking at alpha.
Now, as portfolio constructors, we need metrics that smash risk and return back together to help us compare different funds objectively. Enter the Sharpe ratio.
The Sharpe ratio. Developed by Nobel laureate William Sharpe, it is arguably the most famous risk-adjusted performance metric in the industry. Its entire purpose is to measure the excess return you earn for every single unit of total risk you endure.
Okay, I am going to pause and ask a critical question to the listeners. Do not keep listening until you have an answer in your head.
Go ahead.
Does the Sharpe ratio use beta in its calculation, or does it use standard deviation?
Think about it. It uses standard deviation.
It absolutely must use standard deviation. Why? Because the Sharpe ratio is designed to measure return against total risk. And as we hammered home earlier, standard deviation is the statistical measure of total risk.
Right. Beta only measures market risk. If you use beta, you are calculating the Trainer ratio, which is a completely different concept. Sharpe means standard deviation.
Let's look at the formula. The top part, the numerator, is the portfolio return minus the risk-free rate. We call that the excess return, or the risk premium.
It's the extra money you made to justify getting out of a safe T-bill.
Then you divide that entire top number by the standard deviation of the portfolio.
Think of it philosophically. The Sharpe ratio is asking the portfolio manager, for every unit of volatility, for every drop of sweat, anxiety, and sleeplessness you caused your client on this roller coaster, how much extra return did you deliver above what they could have gotten perfectly safely in a treasury bill?
Let's do a direct comparison to show why this is so important. You are analyzing two mutual funds for a client. Portfolio A generated a total return of 12%. Its standard deviation was 20%.
Okay.
Portfolio B generated a return of 14%. Its standard deviation was 16%. Let's assume the risk-free rate for T-bills is currently 2%.
At first glance, clueless Craig just looks at the returns. 14% is bigger than 12%, so he buys portfolio B. But as an advisor, you must run the Sharpe ratio. Let's do portfolio A first.
Let's do it.
Excess return is 12% minus the 2% risk-free rate, which gives us 10%. We take that 10% and divide it by the standard deviation of 20%. 10 divided by 20 is 0.50. Portfolio A has a Sharpe ratio of 0.5.
Now for portfolio B, the return is 14% minus the 2% risk-free rate. That's an excess return of 12%. We divide that 12 by the standard deviation of 16. 12 divided by 16 is 0.75.
Portfolio B has a Sharpe ratio of 0.75. Yeah. Craig actually got lucky this time. Portfolio B is vastly superior. Not only did it generate a higher raw return, but it did so while exposing the client to significantly less volatility.
A higher Sharpe ratio is always better. It means greater efficiency. Portfolio B generated 0.75 units of return for every one unit of risk. Portfolio A only managed to squeeze out 0.5 units of return for that same exact unit of risk.
The Sharpe ratio strips away the illusion of just chasing the highest yield.
Exactly.
All right, still focusing on how assets behave together in a portfolio, we have to discuss correlation and R-squared. We know diversification is important, but how do we mathematically prove that two assets will actually diversify each other?
We use correlation. Correlation is a descriptive statistic that measures the strength and the direction of the linear relationship between two securities. It is quantified by a correlation coefficient, designated by the lowercase letter r.
And R exists on a strict scale. It can only range from positive 1.0 down to negative 1.0.
Correct. Positive 1.0 indicates perfect positive correlation. The two assets move in perfect lockstep. If asset A goes up 5%, asset B goes up 5%. If A drops, B drops by the exact same proportion.
Zero means absolutely no correlation. Knowing what asset A did today tells you literally nothing about what asset B might do.
And negative 1.0 means perfect negative correlation. They move in exact proportional opposite directions, like a perfectly balanced seesaw.
Here is the trap. I cannot stress this enough. What happens if Clueless Craig builds a massive portfolio? He buys 50 different stocks from 50 different companies, but all 50 of those stocks happen to have a correlation of positive 1.0 to each other.
Craig has wasted his time. He receives absolutely zero diversification benefit.
Zero. This is the core philosophy of modern portfolio theory. Diversification only works if the assets don't move together. You actively want assets with negative correlation, or at least low positive correlation, to smooth out the ride. If the front of the boat dips down, you want an asset in the back of the boat that shifts its weight up. Positive 1.0 gives you no protection.
Now, let's take that correlation coefficient R and square it. If we multiply R by itself, we get R squared, which statisticians call the coefficient of determination.
Sounds like a mouthful. What does R squared actually tell us in plain English?
It tells you the exact percentage of a portfolio's price movement that can be explained by the movement of its benchmark index.
So if a mutual fund has an R squared of 0.90 relative to the S&P 500, it means 90% of the fund's ups and downs are directly caused by or explained by the ups and downs of the broader market. Only 10% of its movement is due to the manager's specific stock picks.
Exactly. It measures how tightly tethered the portfolio is to the index. And why do we care? Because R squared acts as a lie detector test for beta.
Oh, how so?
If your R squared is very high, say 0.95, it means your portfolio behaves very much like the market. Therefore, your beta is highly reliable and meaningful. But if your R squared is extremely low, say 0.20, it means your portfolio is doing its own completely independent thing. In that case, quoting your beta is essentially useless trivia because your portfolio isn't reacting to the market ocean anyway. You cannot trust a beta if the R squared is low.
That is a phenomenal connection. R squared validates beta. All right, taking a breath. We have analyzed stock price movements from every conceivable angle. We've mapped time, quantified risk, evaluated the ocean, and built the portfolio.
It's a lot.
It is, but now it is time to pivot. We are leaving the stock chart behind and opening up the actual accounting books of the companies we are buying. Welcome to Financial Ratios.
This is fundamental analysis. Before we worry about what the stock price is doing, we need to know, can this company actually survive? Is it solvent or is it secretly bleeding to death?
We start with liquidity ratios. The core existential question here is simple. Can the company pay tomorrow's bills? If the bank calls in a loan, can they stroke a check?
To answer that, we look at the balance sheet and compare current assets to current liabilities. Current in accounting means within the next 12 months.
Right.
Current assets are things the company expects to turn into cash within a year. Cash, accounts receivable, and inventory. Current liabilities are debts the company absolutely must pay within a year, like accounts payable, payroll, and short-term debt.
The most basic formula is the current ratio. It is simply current assets divided by current liabilities.
Let's look at frantic Fiona's balance sheet. She has $500,000 in current assets, and she owes $200,000 in current liabilities. Her current ratio is 500,000 divided by 200,000, which equals 2.5.
That sounds great. She can cover her short-term debts 2.5 times over. Higher is better here. It implies a comfortable cushion of liquidity.
But wait, let me hit the mental buzzer. Stop the tape.
That's wrong.
What if Fiona's $500,000 in current assets is mostly a mirage? What if $150,000 of that asset is just a warehouse in New Jersey, completely stuffed to the ceiling with unsold, totally obsolete, blockchain-enabled fidget spinners?
Ah. And you have just identified the fatal flaw of the current ratio. Inventory is legally classified as a current asset because companies hope to sell it within a year.
Hope being the key word.
Exactly. But how quickly can Fiona actually turn thousands of obsolete fidget spinners into hard cash to pay off a very angry bank manager? She probably can't. If a crisis hits, inventory is notoriously illiquid.
So we need a stricter test. We need to strip out the fluff.
We use the quick ratio, which is famously known in finance as the asset test. It is the ultimate measure of immediate survival. The quick ratio takes current assets, but it forcefully subtracts inventory before dividing by current liabilities.
Let's run Fiona's numbers through the acid test. She has $500,000 in current assets minus the $150,000 in fidget spinner inventory. That leaves $350,000 of truly liquid assets.
Now we divide that by the $200,000 in current liabilities. Her quick ratio drops to 1.75.
It is a much more stringent, conservative measure of liquidity.
This is a classic exam comparison. You need to know the only difference between the current ratio and the quick ratio. Ask yourself what it is.
Give a second. It is inventory. That is the single differentiating factor. The quick ratio removes inventory from the numerator. Because it removes a positive number, mathematically, the quick ratio will always be equal to or lower than the current ratio. It can never be higher.
But what if Steady Stan's utility company doesn't have any physical inventory? Like they just provide a service?
If inventory is zero, then subtracting zero does nothing. In that specific case, the current ratio and the quick ratio are mathematically identical.
Boom. That is how you pick up easy points.
Yeah.
Okay, so liquidity tells us if they can survive the week. Next up, leverage ratios. The core question shifts from tomorrow's bills to the overall burden. How much does this company owe in total?
We measure this primarily with the debt-to-equity ratio, the DE ratio. The formula is total liabilities divided by shareholders' equity.
It's basically comparing the money provided by creditors to the money provided by the actual owners. Let's say Steady Stan decides to build a massive new nuclear power plant.
Okay.
He takes on $400,000 in total liabilities, mostly long-term bonds. His shareholders' equity, the value of the stock, is $200,000. $400,000 divided by $200,000 is 2.0.
That means for every $1 of equity the owners put in, Stan has borrowed $2 from creditors. He is highly leveraged.
And leverage is a double-edged sword. In good times, borrowing money to build a plant amplifies your profits. But higher leverage means more structural financial risk.
Definitely.
If the economy tanks or power prices drop, those bondholders still demand their interest payments every month, regardless of Stan's revenue.
This leads to a major conceptual trap on the exam regarding how you interpret financial ratios. The test writers will deliberately try to prey on your intuition about whether a high number is inherently good or bad.
Clueless Craig messes this up every single time.
Craig sees a high number and his brain floods with dopamine. He thinks, high score, winning, I'll buy it. But context is everything. For liquidity ratios, the current and quick ratios, a higher number is generally better.
Right. It means the company is safer, more liquid, and less likely to default on short-term obligations.
But for leverage ratios, like debt to equity, a higher number means more risk. It means the company is relying heavily on borrowed money to keep the lights on. Do not let Craig convince you that a DE ratio of 4.0 is a safe, conservative investment.
You have to mentally separate liquidity from leverage. High liquidity is a safety net. High leverage is a tightrope.
Excellent analogy.
We are entering the final stretch. We know the company can pay its bills. We know how much debt it carries. We've mapped its risk profile. The final piece of the puzzle is looking at the price tag. Is the current stock price a total ripoff, or is it a hidden bargain? We answer this using valuation ratios.
The most famous, widely quoted valuation metric in the world is the price-to-earnings ratio, or the PE ratio. You hear this on financial news networks every day.
The formula is simple. Market price per share divided by the earnings per share, or EPS.
Let's walk through the math. Let's say Steady Stan stock is currently trading on the open market at $60 a share. Looking at the income statement, the company generated $4 of pure profit earnings per share over the last 12 months. 60 divided by 4 is 15. The PE ratio is 15.
What that number actually tells you in plain English is the psychology of the market. It tells you that investors are currently willing to pay $15 out of their pocket today to buy a claim on $1 of Stan's earnings.
But how do we interpret that multiple? This is where behavioral finance intersects with the math. Clueless Craig looks at a stock with a PE of 80 and immediately concludes, "This is ridiculously overvalued. I should short it." Is he right?
It's a massive trap. Craig is wrong. A high PE does not automatically mean a stock is a bad buy or overvalued. A high PE often indicates a growth stock.
Right. Investors are paying $80 for $1 of earnings today because they confidently expect frantic Fiona's tech company to double or triple its earnings over the next few years. They are paying a premium for future growth.
If her earnings do explode, that 80 PE will quickly shrink down to a normal level, and the early investors will be richly rewarded.
Conversely, Craig looks at a company with a PE of 4 and thinks, Wow, what a bargain. I'm getting a massive discount.
Also wrong. A low PE could mean the stock is genuinely undervalued by the market, but it could also signify a value trap.
Right. It might have a PE of 4 because the company is slowly dying, its core product is obsolete, and institutional investors know the earnings are going to collapse to zero next year. You cannot look at a PE in a vacuum. You must compare it to the company's historical average and to its direct industry peers.
And what happens if Fiona's startup is burning through cash? What if she has negative earnings? She's losing $2 a share every quarter.
If a company's earnings are negative, the PE ratio ceases to exist. You cannot mathematically calculate a PE with a negative denominator. The metric simply breaks down, and you have to rely on other valuation tools, like price to sales.
Okay, the final metric in our toolkit, the price to book ratio, or PB.
This ratio compares the market's subjective valuation, the fluctuating stock price, to the company's strict objective accounting value, which is known as book value.
Book value is a liquidation concept. It's basically total assets minus total liabilities divided by the number of outstanding shares. If the company shut down today, sold off everything it owned at accounting value, and paid off all its debts, what is the residual cash left over for each shareholder? That's the book value.
So the PB formula is market price divided by book value per share. If a stock is trading at $45 and the book value is $30, the PB ratio is 1.5. The market is valuing the company at a 50% premium to its raw accounting value.
This is where understanding the nature of the business is critical. Let's apply this to our characters. Is price to book a useful metric for frantic Fiona?
It is a terrible metric for Fiona's tech startup. Why? Because Fiona's primary assets are her proprietary software code, her brand recognition, and the vibes of her highly engaged user base.
Those are intangible assets.
Exactly. They do not show up neatly on a balance sheet. So her accounting book value will look incredibly tiny, making her PB ratio look absurdly, artificially high, even if the company is actually priced fairly by the market.
But what about Steady Stan?
PB is fantastic for Steady Stan. His utility company is deeply asset heavy. He owns physical, tangible things, nuclear power plants, thousands of miles of copper wire, fleets of maintenance trucks, massive transformers.
Those physical assets are easy to depreciate and account for. For asset-heavy companies, manufacturing firms, and financial institutions like banks, price to book is a highly reliable foundational metric.
Context matters. You cannot use a tape measure to weigh a bag of flour. You have to understand what the tool was built to do and use it on the right job.
Precisely. The math is only as good as the context you apply it to.
Right.
All right, take a deep breath. We made it. We've systematically built out the entire analytical toolkit. But before we sign off, we need to lock these concepts into your short-term memory so they survive until test day. It's time for the rapid fire recap. I'm going to throw the concepts out and you fire back the answers.
Ready.
Let's do it. First up, you are comparing mutually exclusive projects. One looks better on NPV, one looks better on IRR. Who wins the showdown?
NPV wins. Always choose the dollar amount over the percentage because NPV's reinvestment assumption is grounded in reality.
Boom. Next, you want to quantify total risk versus market risk. Which metric belongs to which?
Standard deviation measures total risk, the whole bell curve. Beta measures only systematic market risk, the movement of the ocean.
Yes. The Sharpe ratio, what is the denominator?
Standard deviation. Because the Sharpe ratio measures excess return against total risk endured.
Liquidity ratios. Quick ratio versus current ratio. What is the single defining difference?
The quick ratio forcefully removes inventory from current assets. It is the stricter acid test.
Final question. Clueless Craig builds a massive portfolio, but every single asset has a correlation of positive 1.0. How much diversification benefit does he achieve?
Absolutely zero benefit. The assets move in perfect lockstep. If one crashes, they all crash together.
Nailed it. You have the math, you have the tape measures, you have the plumb lines. But I want to leave you with one final, slightly provocative thought to chew on before your exam.
I like this.
We spent this entire deep dive relying on math. But you must remember that all of these analytical tools, NPV, the Sharpe ratio, beta, PE multiples, they all rely on historical data and rigid accounting rules. They assume that the financial world operates rationally. But here is the ultimate limit of your toolkit. None of these formulas, no matter how elegant, can quantify human panic.
They can't model a black swan event.
No. Mathematics can perfectly describe the size of your boat, the historical frequency of the waves, and the correlation of the wind. But no mathematical model can predict when the ocean itself simply dries up, or when a completely unprecedented global event rewrites the rules overnight.
Right. The models assume normal distributions, but financial markets occasionally experience massive fat-tailed events driven by pure human emotion.
The map is incredibly useful, but the map is not the territory.
Exactly. You absolutely need the math to build the house and pass this exam. You cannot advise clients without it. But you must also recognize the limits of the math. Keep your math sharp, but keep your eyes open to the real world.
I love that. You cannot navigate a foggy ocean without your instruments, but you still have to occasionally look out the window. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Trust your preparation. Trust the formulas. Don't be a clueless Greg. And go absolutely crush the Series 65. We will see you next time.